Good morning to everyone. Today we continue with the theme of Gentile equality. We'll be starting the class momentarily in a few minutes. And once you hear the audio feed, please type audio OK at the bottom of your screen. This will confirm for us that you're picking up the sound fine. And again, we will start momentarily, approximately 11:15 a.m. That's Eastern Standard Time. Any part of the class, it will be posted on our audio page just so you can hear the entire class from the beginning. And we'll just start in about a minute. Our friends call in. And again, once you hear the audio, just type in audio OK at the bottom of your screen to confirm that you're picking up the live feed. Good morning.
Hello, Rabbi Gesser.
Yes. Good, how are you? Here's some radio background over there.
That is the conference call thing because the official time is 8:15. The conference call starts.
Okay. Say.
There we go. You there?
Yes.
You there?
Okay, we're here.
Okay. Well, the music was courtesy of the conference call people.
Okay, we'll have to leave a tip next time.
Yeah. And we're the first people, and hopefully they'll be coming. There's the first one.
Okay.
This is Sean.
Sean, how are you?
Good. How are yourself?
Okay, doing well. Enjoying a nice spring out here in New York.
Great. Same here.
Good. We're going to continue. Well, you let me know when you want to start, Brad.
Mary, who or Elsa?
I don't know. I think just go ahead and start.
Yeah, go ahead and start.
They come in when they do.
Okay. All right. And thank you to Daryl, who's online. Just confirmed that the audio is being picked up by the web. Okay, so we're ready to go. Okay. Just want to continue a bit today on a little bit of an ongoing theme that we have been discussing regarding Gentile and Jew equality. Specifically, the issue came up regarding whether or not a Jew has a superior soul or not. And there were a few more arguments that I wanted to just bring to our attention, just to think about ourselves. Because as the rabbis say, and we'll probably bring this point up again, in the Olenu prayer that we say at least three times every day, sometimes four and sometimes five, depending if it's Yom Kippur. I think we say it five, but nonetheless, in that prayer, and how's the sound over there, Brian? Brad, is that okay? You picking me up fine?
Perfect.
Okay. Okay, so the... Carol, how are you? Good morning. Okay, we just started. I was just giving a little outline as to what I wanted to take up today. And that is the issue of the notion, which we can call the heretical notion of Jewish superiority, which is echoed quite a bit. And thank God it's not echoed by everyone, and I think people are coming around to their senses and realizing that it defies Torah sentences and Torah principles. I was just quoting that in the Olenu prayer. It states that you should know it today, meaning referring to the Torah, you should know it today, and then you should place it on your heart. Now, one of the greatest minds we had was Rabbi Pekuda, who, Bachya ibn Pekuda, I mean, it's Bachya the son of Pekuda, who wrote the Duties of the Heart. It's in English. And it's a very worthwhile book to get. He talks about perfection, how he reflected on the fact that he didn't see any works written about the duties of the heart, the proper thoughts and ideas that a person should have regarding his obligation to God and his notions of God. And he compiled a beautiful work, which is very fundamental in terms of our human beings' understanding of God and our obligation here on earth. And at one point in the introduction, which is very crucial to read that introduction, he talks about how it's a sin or it's a crime that a person is committing if he listens to the rabbis but does not think for himself. So if a person would just listen to whatever the rabbis tell him but he does not think for himself, he violates what he says is the following statement. You should know it today and you should place it upon your heart. So knowing it today means that you should listen to what the rabbis teach you, because they're the ones that communicate the traditions down the line from Sinai to the present. But we're not supposed to just stop there at listening to what the words are. We have to then think about what they said and accept it with our own intelligent conviction, reasoning, and in proving it to ourselves that the words are true. In Talmud Chulin on 124a, I believe, towards the bottom of the page, so there's a rabbi there who says that he would not listen to even Joshua, the son of Nun, who took over the Jews after Moses passed away. And he said that I wouldn't even listen to him, meaning that the first transmitter of the Torah from Moses, this rabbi in the Talmud, said he wouldn't listen to unless it made sense, meaning that we don't just follow a person because of a position or status, unless, of course, it's a king, then there's ways, you know, that we have to follow in terms of, that's part of the Torah. The Torah tells us you must follow the king. But if a rabbi tells you something and it doesn't make sense, there's no obligation, unless you asked about a ruling for yourself, then you're obligated. But you're even allowed to ask a few rabbis. You don't have to go with what that rabbi says. And on top of that, a person is even allowed to decide for himself if he has studied the area as thoroughly. Okay, but the bottom line is that we are supposed to use our own reasoning. That's why God gave each individual human being reasoning. If God wanted us just to follow other people blindly, then he would have just given us memory. We would not have need the faculty of reasoning. Okay, so that's a very important idea, is that we have reasoning because we are demanded by God to use it for ourselves. And we hear an idea, we have to think about it. Is this true or not? Nobody can tell us. Like Rabbi Chay said very well, nobody can tell you what you believe. A person, a rabbi, can tell you what you should do in action, because there are practical needs in the community. There's practical needs in terms of the Torah, in terms of your own perfection. So they can tell you what to do, but nobody can tell you what to think. And there is no obligation to And it's an impossibility as well. There can't be a command that you must agree with this person. It's impossible. You can't agree with somebody if you don't. There's nothing that a person, you can verbalize the words, yes, I agree, and you can be lying, but it's an impossibility to actually agree with an opinion if you do not. And that's precisely why God wants us to think. He wants us to arrive at our own convictions. He wants us to, that's really where our own merit is when we actually use our intelligence and we arrive at a conviction and then we follow through with action. Okay, so it's a crucial idea. It's verses in the Torah, and it's something which you see the great rabbi who wrote Duties of the Heart, Choves Halevavos, writes in his introduction that you're committing a grave sin if you just listen to the rabbis and you don't follow that up with thinking what they said and seeing it as being true or false for yourself. Okay. Now, that being said, again, we had addressed in the past, maybe not so much here in the class, but we had addressed the concept of whether or not the Jew has the superior soul or not that we hear. And the first thing, of course, we show as a rejection to that is that God created Adam and Eve, and all mankind today comes from that original couple. After they sinned, God made a slight change, well, not a slight change, he made a major change in the psyche, meaning initially man was not clothed and he had no embarrassment. The Torah says that openly. Afterwards, when he expressed the ability to sin very easily, so God then created in man a new faculty, and that is the conscience. So before the sin, man was able to, as Maimonides talks about in the second chapter of his Guide for the Perplexed. There's three books in the Guide for the Perplexed. In the first book, the second chapter, he addresses this and he explains how originally man was intelligent. He had knowledge of true and false, but he did not have knowledge of right and wrong. Morality just didn't exist. That's why it says they were both naked and they were not embarrassed, because embarrassment only comes from a sense of morality. But man didn't have morality at first. Why didn't they have morality at first? The reason being because it's something which takes away energy and time from being involved in pondering truths. It says that before God even gave the woman to man, he gave one last-ditch effort for man to be involved in naming the animals, meaning to be involved in truths, a higher level of functionality. And, of course, woman was originally intended. We have to understand the story, because as the rabbis say, that man was created and woman, they were both created, joined at the backs. So whether that's literal or not, it means that they were both equally intended. And of course you need that, because procreation, you need both parties. And that was God's will. But the morality only came in as a means to address man's ability to sin. Since man was able to sin and not listen to God and that one command, so then God gave him a sense of morality. So this way now he has a secondary brake system, wherein even if he's about to sin, now he can feel, is this right to do, is this wrong to do? So it was a gift that God gave to man as a secondary system to stop him from sinning. If he can't stop from sinning just based on his intelligent observation that something is damaging, so now perhaps having a feeling of remorse or guilt would help him to stop sinning. Okay, and then what came along with that was the sense of, you know, being naked is not proper. So that's why nudity became something distasteful to Adam and Eve after the sin. Because that was just part of the system of morality that God now gifted to man. Okay, but after that point, after that change, there was no change in human beings. That means that every single human being today alive comes from Adam and Eve. Of course, most of the world was destroyed by the flood, but Noah and his wife and his three sons and daughters-in-law, so those eight people who repopulated the world also came from Adam and Eve. So that means we all share the exact same design. And when we said that also, that when certain people, ironically, want to say, yes, the Jew has a superior soul, and look, you know, if they rely on the verse that where God says that he put the Tzelem Elokim, the image of God he put in man, But who was the man that he put the image of God in? That man, meaning Adam, was not Jewish. He was Gentile. There was no such thing as a Jew until the Torah was given at Sinai. They were descendants of Abraham, yes, but Abraham was no more Jewish than the inhabitants of Sodom that God destroyed because of their sins. So only once God gave his system, so now he designated a certain group of people that were monotheistic to have the Torah system, but to have it as a means to teach the rest of the world. God didn't populate the entire world just so that a few select people can benefit and the rest of the people are on their own. No, that's not what happened. You see, the God gave commands to Adam. He gave commands to Noah. This is all prior to Judaism existing. So that's the first thing that we lodged. The first argument that the person who received this what people want to say, this form of God, this image of God, and they want to say that's a superior soul, well, that was a Gentile, that wasn't even a Jew. So that destroys that argument, that using that to try to prove that a Jew has a superior soul. And there's another argument that people want to say, but they completely misquote a verse in Job. And I think it's about chapter 31. I don't have it in front of me. And they misquote it. And when Job is, his three friends are trying to reason with him and explain to him why he has such a tragic life at this point, prior to which he was successful and had great wealth and children and animals. And now he was smitten head to toe with leprosy and he lost all his children, lost all his wealth, all his animals. And his friends are trying to explain to him why he must have done something or some reasoning they were trying to offer him. And on every single account, he was able to show them how they were wrong. And on one account, he says to them, even when I looked at a woman for a prospect of a wife for one of my sons, I would not look any longer at her than was necessary to discern if she was good in terms of her qualities. So he's saying that he never looked at any longer, not a moment longer would he look, because then it would have just been lust. And he says to them that, because if I had looked longer, so then what portion would I have with God above? Meaning it would forfeit his eternal life after he dies. But people take that verse and they corrupt it, and they just quote the words, portion of God above. And they say that means there is a portion of God above in every man, which is completely a distortion of that verse. All right, so we're following so far. We have two arguments right from the Torah. One is in Genesis and one is in Job. And the second one, you see, it's a clear distortion. Job is just saying, what portion would I have with God above? And people today, they drop off the word what at the beginning of that verse, and they say, portion of God above. And they say, oh, look, you see, there's a portion of God above in every man. Which is completely heretical, because we know clearly that something physical is something that can be divided. That God that is not physical can't be divided. There can't be parts to God. This is something which every single thinker agrees is true, the greatest rabbis. So the concept of saying there's a piece of God in every human being, or there's a spark or something, completely against reason and completely against the Torah. All right, so there's really no basis for this notion of Jewish superiority. There was no time where God ever made any new invention of man. We are all descendants of the same Adam and Eve. That means everybody shares the same design. The only difference between the Jew and the Gentiles, that at a certain point, Abraham was able to extricate himself from idolatry and reason with him, for himself without a teacher, and discover the fact that this whole lifestyle that the entire world and his culture were leading is completely false. And he was able to use his mind to prove to them that they were wrong. And he started to amass thousands and thousands of followers, I think even tens of thousands of followers. They saw the reasoning, because the reasoning is something which can overpower emotional belief, because reasoning is stronger. Now, because of this lifestyle, it's my understanding that, I mean, we know the fact that God had selected him, but why would God select Abraham? Why was he a great person to use as a leader of a new people? because he showed that even from the depths of the worst sin of idolatry, using intelligence alone, we have the ability to extricate ourselves from it and to live properly. So no, it really removes any argument that a person would have that it's not my fault. If I'm living corruptly, it's not my fault. Well, Abraham was showing that he was able to use the intelligence without a teacher. He was completely self-sufficient. And I believe that is one of the major reasons why the nation of the Jews is built around him. Because now we identify Judaism with that first person who's monotheistic, and he was able to discover things on his own. So it's internal in man's makeup. And he was a Gentile, and God loved him. So, again, it has to be something which we see clearly. We have to be honest. We can't keep on echoing just what many, many other Jews may say. It doesn't mean that it's correct. Just because something is written in the book, yes, it's written in the book that there's a piece of God in man. But it's completely a lie. So it doesn't matter that it's printed. People make mistakes, and authors of those books that have that statement that there's a piece of God in man, those authors are on a much lower level than Moses, and Moses himself made mistakes. So why do people today want to try to deify rabbis that are on a such a lower level than Moses, and say, oh, this rabbi said it, that means it's got to be correct? That's not true. You see the duties of the heart. The author, Ibn Bakhiyah ibn Pakuda, he says, no, you're sinning. The Torah demands that you listen to the rabbis, but then reason for yourself. God gave you intelligence, so you should think about it. Is this rabbi telling you something true or false? And the Talmud, 124a in Chulin, it tells you that the rabbi says, I wouldn't even listen to Joshua, the son of Nun, who was the leader after Moses. I wouldn't even listen to him if it wasn't true. So we don't just we don't respect reputations over truth. But that's today's world. Unfortunately, people are still too infantile and deficient in their independence and thinking. But even people like that, if that's what they'll tell you, listen, I can't think, I got to follow the rabbis. Tell me, is it? Well, the rabbis tell you to think for yourself. So it comes right back at you. There's no escape. Okay, let's pause here and see any comments or questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Weren't there other pockets of monotheism, like there was the school of Shem? So, you know, yes, Abraham, he wasn't associated with that, so he came to the realization on his own that there was one true God. But what about, you know, other places in the world? You know, we know there was the school of Shem. Were there other places? And then what made it so that Abraham was the only one from whence it continued forward in time?
I can't answer if there are other schools. I do not know. I never heard of any others. Why Abraham? I'm giving my own opinion. Why Abraham? Because he actually demonstrated that a person can raise himself from the lowest depths of corruption just using intelligence alone. Perhaps Shem never had the corrupt lifestyle, so Abraham was a better model. I don't know. That's, again, God's decision. So when it comes to why God did something, well, what's the reason behind a mitzvah? We can suggest possibilities, and Maimonides even says, wherever you can give a reason for a mitzvah, give a reason. Why God selected Abraham, you see that he lived a certain lifestyle. Were there others that lived it? Yes, like you're saying. But why he selected Abraham and that Shem, I don't know. I could only suggest that there is a benefit in the fact that he was at the lowest low and raised himself to the highest level. So it set an example for anybody. Whereas Shem, you know, was the leader. So then the person who was in the lowest depths would say, well, listen, Shem had, you know, a father, Noah. So he had a good youth. But me, it's not my fault. I didn't have a good youth. But by setting up Abraham, that removes that question.
Thank you.
Okay. And Fred in Ventura, Florida, is asking, when did Moses become Jewish? Well, everybody became Jewish, I guess you could say, when they received the Torah at Sinai. That's when the nation became. That's when the system was codified, was put into place. Yeah, but there really wasn't such a thing as Jew. There were monotheists. There was Abraham, there was Isaac, there was Jacob long before Moses. But in terms of having the people, so that was when everybody accepted it as the group at Sinai. And they did get a few laws prior to Sinai, and at Moreh. Okay. Any other questions?
Rabbi?
Yes, Cal, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Just about this idea of pieces of God or a part of God. Just as an artist will create a painting, it's not a physical transfer of something, but it is a an idea or something that's transmitted from the artist. Can you look at the at God's creation that way?
Well, let me just understand the example first. You're saying that a painter is going to imbue the painting with some ideas, meaning what is it? The painting itself is just canvas and, you know, the pigments. So there's really nothing in the painting that is, you know, not physical. We look at it and we'll interpret things and we'll learn things about the person who made the painting. It'll be a reflection. Like, for example, a mirror. When we look at a mirror and we see our reflection, we are not in the mirror. The mirror is, because if you walk away from the mirror, so then you're not there. So it's not really in the mirror. The mirror itself is glass, and it has a certain finish that is very smooth. And the smoother something is, the more it reflects light, because light bounces off of every surface. But the light, or the person, is not going into the mirror. So it's something which we, our eyes interpret light. If there was no light in the room right now, even though you're standing in front of the mirror, you would not be in the mirror.
Right.
So similarly, when you paint, the painting itself is only pigment and the canvas that you painted it on. It's purely physical. When we see things that, oh, we see a style that's continuous, we can tell the artist, yes, that's because it is something which we can interpret, but that's all taking place in our mind. So when God creates a person, so the painting example is really not accurate, but just to take it to the next case, which is what we're discussing. So when God creates a human being and he places a soul in a human being, it's a complete new creation. Our sitter says in the beginning, it says that the soul that you planted in us, you created. So before I had a soul, it was not existent at all. So it wasn't coming from God. It wasn't coming from anywhere. It was completely, you know, like the universe is created from nothingness. We don't know how. The soul also. So it's not any part of God. Again, when we try to say that, what we're doing is that it's a hard thing to break away from, but we have to. We have to break away from this. What we're doing is we are projecting. We have a certain sense of how the world operates. And that's all we see as the physical world. And we try to project onto other areas that they must work the same way. I see that there's a leaf and it falls off a tree. But it was part of the tree. It's here now on the ground, but it was there up on the branch earlier today. So now there's a soul in me, or maybe it was someplace before this up in heaven, maybe part of God. So we try to throw God into a physical universe that is of space. But we have to stop right there, because that's not true. We don't know anything about what God is. All we know is that there is a creator of this universe. What he is, we don't know. We know that somewhat we can talk about that he's kind, that he does that which is good. He created man, and he had no obligation to, and that really reflects his goodness, that he created things that can enjoy perceiving him. So some people make another mistake and they say, well, it must be God is egotistical, that he wants man to praise him. No, it's for us. So he creates man with the ability to perceive beautiful ideas and to enjoy an existence, whereas there was no such thing as man before. So, I mean, there's many illustrations, but I think, I mean, tell me if I'm clear in terms of explaining this to you.
I think I see it. When you say everything, or when we say everything comes from God, I think it's easy to assume that, or to project that there is some sort of a transmission from God, because we are the creations from God. But I can see where you don't want to get into a physical sense of a piece of God.
Right, because God himself is not physical. If he created the physical right. world, that means that he is beyond physical.
Right.
Right. Okay. All right. Fred, we're just going to take up questions regarding the class today. So if you want to write those questions in, be glad to take them up. But I just want to stay to the points that we're on today. All right? So I appreciate that. Right. Any other questions? Brian? Cal? Is Doug with us today?
I am. Sounds clear to me, Rabbi. Thank you.
And Doug, I did get your email regarding the suggestion of taking up practically the laws about Noahide. So that's a good idea.
Thank you.
I'm already considering how we go about doing that, and I'll speak to God willing, Rabbi Chait, Rabbi Mann, and Rabbi Mann also wants him to communicate that he did get the message, and regarding the new program that you're working on, he said he'd be more than happy to assist as well. So you just let us know how we can. He wanted me to convey that because he's not on the computer much anymore.
Okay.
All right. All right. So I think what we said up to this point just recaps. Some of the ideas that we were discussing, but it really shows, again, you have to go back to the source. You have to see the verses. And when you see the Torah verses, this is the real authority, the only authority to what Judaism and Torah is. What people say today, forget about it. If it's not based in the Torah source, if it's not an accurate reading of a verse, then don't listen to it. Think for yourself. Look at the sources, too. Ask people for sources. Nice, so we get out of a lot of problems that way. All right. And I just wanted to take up a few more thoughts that I had on this, which just brings out this idea more that there is absolutely no difference whatsoever, Jew, Gentile. There's a difference in designation. That's it. There's no difference in design or potential whatsoever. I had also mentioned last time that the Torah, in so many cases, this week's Parsha, next week's Parsha, and so many other cases, it says this one Torah for the born Jew and for the convert. That means that a person converts, they keep the exact same system as the Jew. And there's no change in the convert before or afterwards. He just accepted himself, part of himself, to follow it. That means he has the same exact design. You can't have the same Torah for two people if two people are fundamentally different in their capacity and their abilities. So the Torah itself says numerous times, one Torah, Torah Chas, the Ger or the Ezrach. One Torah you should have for both the convert and for the Jew. No difference. So it's clear. It's not something which is any possibility of it being an incorrect statement because there's so many sources on this. These are God's words. That's the ultimate authority. So it's a closed case. All right. Now I just want to quote a few more. This is from Maimonides, which touches on the subject. He says, this is actually brought down in the intro to the Guide for the Perplexed, or the introduction. It says that Maimonides had appended to his commentary on the Mishnah the following words. He says, quote, "I have now finished this work in accordance with my promise, and I fervently beseech the Almighty to save us from error. If there be one who shall discover an inaccuracy in this commentary, or shall have a better explanation to offer, let my attention be directed to it." End quote. So Maimonides, who knew his position as a genius, and knew that he was one of very, very few in all the population of man, of all generations, he still stated in his commentary that if anybody discovers a mistake I made, he should offer it, or if there's a better explanation, please tell me. So he was admitting error. He was admitting the ability to make mistakes. So again, we shouldn't be looking at books today and saying that people on a much lower level, admittedly, than Maimonides, that whatever they say is right. No, you can have errors in books. So when it says in the book that there's a piece of God in everybody, it's a mistake. People make mistakes. Right? The greatest of people make mistakes. All right? And we know clearly that Moses made a mistake. We know that there was one case where Moses was rebuking his brother Aaron for not eating a certain sacrifice. But this is right after the two sons of Aaron were killed. So Aaron responded to Moses, "Would this have been pleasing before God?" And Moses understood and he agreed. He said Aaron was right. So you see, Aaron did not just accept Moses' word. He thought for himself. And this is an illustration for us. It's not just that we would ever, that this is for them to do, but not for us. God would not have given us reasoning and the ability to think if he did not want us to use it. Each one of us. Okay. There's a case in the Talmud, another support. The case in the Talmud where the rabbis had said we are wrong about something. I think it was mathematics. They said that we are wrong and the Greeks are correct. Another case where you see clearly the greatest minds admitted error. Right? Torah is not about hero worship. Right? That's something in Christianity where you have these saints that are flawless. They're infallible. Unfortunately, that has crept into Judaism as well. And you see that with the preponderance of books about this rabbi and that rabbi, and making all these biographies about current day rabbis and so on, not to take away anything from the rabbis, but let's see a few books, or at least one book, which talks about the greatness of God. But you don't see that. It's all about the person. People have become very attached to the individual. All right, and that's a problem. All right. Now there's a point I want to make that's going to require you to think. All right? Again, going back now to this Jewish superior soul concept that people have. So I'm just going to read something, and you tell me what you think, okay? If the Jewish soul is superior, so what is the consequence of that statement? What exactly are these people trying to say by saying the Jewish soul is superior? All right? Is my free will then taken away? Meaning, if you're telling me that because you have a Jewish soul, you are now better. I mean, that is clearly what the proponents of this notion want to claim. The Jews have a more perfected soul. That means that they are more perfected. That means they are better. Okay, but then that is not due to our own actions. That means we're born with a superior ability. If that's true, don't you have to then say that I cannot earn any reward and I cannot get punished for any sin? I mean, wouldn't that follow?
Why would that follow?
You're telling me I have as a Jew, I have a superior soul than somebody who's not Jewish. So what does that translate into? Aren't they saying that I'm better? And isn't better in terms of my life following God? So, he's trying to say basically that I am less or that I will not sin. Now, if you're saying, Doug, that, well, that's not a clear statement, so let's take the other angle. Let's take the other angle. So then, okay, and Alberto had a question. He says, maybe it's not better, but simply different. There's no grounds to say that, Alberto. All right, I'll tell you why. Because we know as Jews that we have free will. I know I have free will. I'm a Jew. I have free will. I can sin. I have sinned in the past. I will sin in the future. I can decide between doing X and Y. Now, if I have that ability to sin, that is something which is the truth. Does anybody in the class right now disagree with that? No, okay. So it makes sense, of course. It's clear. I have the free will right now to say something. I could mislead you right now. I could do a sin right now, and I could tell you something which is not true about the Torah. I could mislead you. I could do a very grave sin. I have that free will right now. Nothing is holding me back from doing it. All right? So if that's the case, so I have the ability to sin. Now, would you also agree that a Gentile has the ability to do something good? Would everybody agree with that?
Yes.
Yes. All right. Clear. Makes sense. All right. The very fact is that you just answered that question. You have the ability to answer that question. You have free will. Now, if you use your free will for good, and I use my free will to do the gravest sins, who's a better person? You have to say that I'm a sinner and the Gentile's a better person. Just like the rabbis say in the Talmud, that a Gentile that follows his commands is equal to a high priest. Maybe, you know, just thinking, maybe they say it's a high priest because he gets to fulfill more laws than other Jews, because Jews can't do, a regular Jew and Israelite who comes from the other tribes can't do all the service in the temple. And even the other priests can do some service, but the high priest gets to do the most work. And the Talmud is telling you that the high priest is the same level as a Gentile who was perfected. So you see the Talmud is clearly. So here you have an open proof, not just from the Talmud, but reasoning alone. Reasoning alone tells you that since you have the free will as a Jew, you can sin. Right? So what have you gained? This is now my question. What have these people gained who say the Jew has a superior soul? I mean, practically, what's the consequence of that statement? Now, this is like to open that up right now if anybody wants to defend that position.
Well, I wonder if instead of saying they're a superior soul in that they won't sin, what they're saying is God somehow loves them more.
Well, God doesn't love them more because the Torah says if you do X, Y, and Z, you're killed or you lose your soul. The Torah says that openly. Not only that, God says that we are commanded to love the convert. Meaning God knows the nature of the convert, and the widow, and the orphan, and that they're sensitive, and that they have nobody. And he recognizes that he made human emotions, so he understands who is going to be most sensitive, most susceptible, who's going to be the most humble. So he says, no, go out of your way to love these people. So that means God...
I wonder if they would...
What's that?
Sorry, go ahead.
That was all I had to say. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I wonder if they would say, well, yeah, but if a convert converts, I mean, if someone converts, then they're a Jew, and so now they have a superior soul. But all those Gentiles out there, they're kind of a lower class life form.
Yeah, well, now let's think about that. This concept that now that they're converted, now they have a superior soul. Let's think about this. What... And by the way, if the screen, some people are online with the screen, if the screen gets an error code, just hit your enter key. That'll clear it. Sometimes that happens. All right, but in terms of the point that the convert now is given a higher soul after they convert, it doesn't make sense to me, because at what state did the person decide to convert? Where is the great merit in the convert? Is it not before they converted and they saw the ideas as true? And then the conversion was merely just a practical thing that they had to go through. But wasn't there perfection in their mind and in their character prior to converting?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yes, it is. I think it really shows. It clarifies that. The real perfection of the convert was there beforehand. The real perfection of Abraham was before the Torah was given. Okay, just going to have a few questions here from Alberto on screen. Let me just read them. Let's just read them here. So Alberto is writing like this. That there's no difference between... I responded to him and I said there's no difference between the Gentile and Jew. So here's, okay, yes, but if the covenant of Sinai gave me some obligations that non-Jews do not have, maybe it's because I'm different from him. No, that you only have that because you're a descendant of Abraham. That's the only reason why you have those obligations, Alberto. Not because there's any design difference between you and the Gentile. We're identical. Okay. And then he writes about the difference between the covenant of Noah and Sinai. I'm not sure what you mean about that. Okay. Why, he asked the next question, why then all humans do not have the same path to follow? Well, originally humans did have the same path to follow. The Torah was not given until almost 2,500 years after man was created. God, in his wisdom, decided at a certain point that since maybe the world was so corrupt and all this idolatry was spread and it proliferated throughout the entire world, he wanted to help man, and he selected Abraham, who was following a monotheistic lifestyle, and asked him and his descendants to keep this system for the rest of the world. So it really is for everybody. And we talk about in the future where everybody will recognize God. We started Isaiah a few months ago, and it talks in the beginning over there how the Gentiles will literally stream like a river flows. They will flow to Jerusalem to learn Torah because they will recognize in the future the truth of Torah. So it is really for everybody. There's no difference. The only reason why there's different paths right now is due to man's, you could say it's due to man's corruption. So therefore God selected those few that were not corrupt and told them, here's a Torah system, teach the rest of the world. Alberto goes on and he's writing, if the covenant of Sinai gives me some obligations that Jews do not have, okay, that you wrote, I think you just pasted it in. Okay, good. Okay, so we answered your questions. And the last note he's writing is, so God created that difference. God gave the Jews some orders and to non-Jews other ones. Right. I mean, the same exact fundamentals. It's just that there's a minimal system for non-Jews. But again, I am completely of the opinion that a non-Jew Gentile is going to benefit equally as a Jew the more a non-Jew takes on. And of course, by this is a question, Doug, that we had touched on last time, that the point is that the more mitzvahs you have, definitely the more perfection you gain. But if a Gentile would be studying his 60 or so laws that are part of the seven Noahides, and this takes up his entire time and he's following them perfectly, he's not losing anything because he's applying all his time. He is using all his time that's available to him in study. That's the same thing a Jew does. Okay. All right, so getting back to the question. So we said then there is no gain by a person that's supporting a view that there's a superior Jewish soul, because what are you saying? Are you saying that there's no free will? Well, if there's no free will, then I just have to do the good because I'm superior, so I can't get any reward then, because then it's not due to me. It's due to God. He made my soul better, so therefore I must do better things. But if God made my soul better, it's not me, so I should not get reward. I should also not get punished. And I can't get punished evidently because if my soul is better, it's not going to sin. But we know that every Jew has free will, just like a Gentile. So there is nothing gained by saying that there is a superiority to the Jewish soul. Right? And the example we gave is clear. A Jew that sins is punished, and a Jew can sin to the point where he loses his alma bat. That means his soul is exterminated upon his death, his physical death. Whereas a Gentile that keeps the seven Noahid laws and keeps all the halachas and follows God and has a love for God, he's going to have the next world. He will have alma bat. That means a Gentile surpassed this Jew. So it's not based on design of who's better, who's worse. It's based on free will. And everybody has equal free will. Okay? So I think these arguments and these sources, just really, it's case closed regarding this question. All right, there's nothing in the Torah which talks about anything greater in the design of the Jew. It's just a role. We have an obligation. And the truth is, you could even say it's a service. You think, like people look at policemen, oh, they're better, they have the uniforms. No, policemen are really a public servant. They really have to serve the public. So they're inferior to the public. Right? Or at least they have to do an act of servitude to the public. So the Jew has this obligation to do the servitude. He's got the mission. He now has to study and make sure that this Torah is intact and present it properly to the world. How come Jews don't say that? How come this is completely overlooked, this relationship of the fact that we have to service the rest of the world?
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
Is there much open talk within the Jewish community of that obligation to go out and teach the world?
In our parts, yes. I'm not sure about the other communities. I would think that there is a lot of a lot of Jewish communities are part of ghettoized, and there is this feeling of superiority, and there are derogatory statements like, oh, that they use the term goy. Now, goy is a Hebrew word which just means nation, or but they use it like, you know, like disparagingly, anybody who's not Jewish. And it's something which is completely wrong. It's what we call a chil Hashem. It's something which it really defaces, and you know, God's intent for the world. And you know, it's unfortunate, but ego is something which is alive and well, and you know, this type of arrogance, which is baseless, it just stems from that need in the person to feel superior, and that's where, you know, evil speech comes from, lashon hara. But again, it's a lack of studying, it's a lack of whatchamacallit, a realization of truths. However, you know, there are individuals, you know, Rabbi Mann, Rabbi Chait, Rabbi Zucker, people have really taken upon themselves to you know, to really make an effort and to teach and to make, you know, the truth known and to reach out to Jew and non-Jew alike. And I remember Rabbi Chait talking about, he has a place up in New Hampshire, and he has a friends there that Gentile friends, and you know, great relationships with them. There's none of this negativity. You know, we recognize it. I mean, if a person knows the truth, he sees that God's will is that every single human who's alive has a soul for a reason. So each one of us, and this is something which we're actually starting a program now, which maybe it'll tie into what Doug is doing, but at Masora, we're starting in the next week or so, an outreach, and this is going to extend to Jew and Gentile alike. And hopefully it'll get a lot of people involved, teaching right ideas, giving the ammunition to respond to people, you know, in the form of, you know, very, you know, clear articles with sources, asking people to circulate them, asking people to, you know, start one-on-one sessions with other people, to make themselves available to their friends, to start learning groups where they can. And by doing this, it'll again hopefully make a dent in, you know, in this need that you're talking about, which is a very, you know, it's a very important need that things are presented properly. I had a, if you want to take a look, last week's Jewish Press, page 7, you'll take a look. These sentiments, they reprinted. It wasn't even my idea. I was talking to one of the editors. There were a couple of girls about 3 months ago that were missing, and I saw an email, came across the inbox, and I said, okay, you know, this is important. So I sent an immediate email out to, you know, all of Masora's subscribers. And then I sent it, you know, I said, you know, the Jewish Press is gigantic. They have 100 or 200,000 readers. I asked them to please publicize it. So they called back, and they just wanted to verify the story. They ran it. And when I was talking to one of the editors on the phone, I mentioned to him that I said, you know, it's amazing, you know, certain people, you know, had emailed in here to Masora asking if these two girls that are missing are Jewish. And I said, you know, I was telling the story over to the editor at the press, and I said, what difference does it make? So when I said that, he says to me, would you mind elaborating on that, and we'll run it. I said, I'd be glad to. So they ran it last week. So if you want to take a look, you'll have all the sources too, and hopefully this, you know, will impact on the Jewish community, because they have a large readership, and it will make them realize the actual sources, make them see the mistakes. And I'm going to probably follow it up again. I'll see. I don't know if they'll, you know, print again this week, because there are certain comments that came in. You know, there were, I think, about 4 people who wrote in this week. 3 of them were stuck on the idea that the Jew is superior. One person actually saw it, and he was very happy to see this printed, because that's, he understands the truth. So I may just write in just to clarify something from those other 3 people who were still making a mistake. But I'm trying to get a publicity. So it should be realized. It's just that certain things become so ingrained and so blindly accepted, and it happens in every community. It's not just Judaism. It's everywhere. So, you know, we really, the thrust has to be, think, you know, see something is true. You want to know what Judaism is? You want to know what the Torah says? Read it. See what the sources say. And let's see here. Alberto is making a comment here. If the Torah gives the Jews a place in the world to come, and it has many mitzvahs, so may we say that the non-Jew does not have the same in quality, because he only follows the 7 laws? If a person just follows the 7, you're right, there's going to be a minimal type of, it's not a system of perfection, like Rabbi Chait says. So no, there's not a same level. You're right. There will not be the same level of perfection, for somebody who follows, like a Jew. If a Jew follows only the seven, he will have the same, but he may even have a worse fate because he's actually breaking laws. So it's in terms of how God metes out justice, that, you know, it's not something which I have knowledge of, but I think we can say that the more a person works on his perfection, like, for example, there's no, it doesn't say in the seven Noahide laws that you shouldn't speak Lashon Hara. Now, maybe I'm incorrect, and it is subsumed under one of them. I didn't see it, and I'm still studying the area myself, just so I could speak more knowledgeably of it, but I'm still going through the Talmud on this. I didn't come across that yet, but certainly if we say that speaking evil about a friend is not a Noahide law, so if I'm a Noahide and I keep on my seven but I speak bad all day long, I mean, what type of perfection do I have? So definitely if I hold my tongue back and I speak nicely about people, of course I'm more perfected. So that has to be the case. All right, so Rabbi Chait explained, he said anything regarding, I had the question with him regarding teaching, because there is a restriction on Gentile to learn Torah. That's not part of what he's going to follow. And the reasoning, my understanding is because it's the Jew who has the role as being the Torah educator. And for the Gentile to do that, it would blur the lines, and then it would mislead people as to who the real Torah educators are. And the Gentile is not following as many because he doesn't have the obligation to follow them, so his knowledge is not going to be on par with the Jew who has to study the laws meticulously, because there's so many more laws. So if the Gentile would study, he would present himself, and it would blur the lines between who's the real Torah educator, and it would ruin the Torah system. All right? So the concept is, though, is that if the Gentile is going to keep the law, you can. And Maimonides says that we do not prevent the Gentile from keeping them exactly according to the law. That means you do keep them properly. You keep them just like the Jew if you're going to take on law. And it's not because of any inequality that there's a few that can't be followed. It's simply because God wants there to be an isolated group that's recognized as being the ones who have the law. And they're the ones you go to study it. That's it. It's merely a practical thing. I mean, I heard recently, somebody told me there's some Jewish community in Brooklyn that has this edict. I'm not sure why they set it up, but they said a Jew cannot marry a convert. And I'm not sure what happened, but there is a basis that by the days of King David, they did not accept Gentiles to convert, nor during the days of King Solomon. And they said the reasoning was because you couldn't tell for sure if it was a real, sincere conversion. Because during King David's times, people might have converted because they were afraid of David, you know, destroying them. He was the greatest warrior. And in the times of Solomon, the wealth was fantastic, so the rabbis thought, well, maybe the people are converting for the sake of wealth. They didn't know for sure if there were any ulterior motives. So they made a rule at that time. But not because there was any less capacity in the convert to live a proper life. So many of the greatest people, the greatest leaders, are Gentiles that had converted. So, but again, you know, we're after truth, so we discuss everything. The Torah doesn't hide anything, and we don't hide anything. We discuss it, and we'll see that everything really comes to a very beautiful picture, and everything is fair and just in God's system. We have to seek it out. All right, let me pause here, see if there's any comments or questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
If I was a math teacher, I would be required to know way more than what I'm imparting to my students. And that doesn't mean that there might be a student out there who would eventually pass me up, but in general, I'm required to know way more. Now, couldn't you say the same thing if the Jews are to be the teachers? They're required to know way more than what the Gentiles are so that they can be a good teacher. So it's just an obligation so that they can do their job right.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Exactly. And that's why really, even more so, this should cause people even more so to to really spend more time studying so they can present the Torah properly and not mislead other Jews and mislead Gentiles and say that you're better or to say that the mitzvah is this way or not that way. So a person has a big obligation to teach, and a person has an obligation to know what he's about to teach, that it's really a true reflection of God's will, of God's Torah. Okay. And let's see, Rosora is writing as follows. Perhaps a Noahide behaves in accordance to a truth that is beyond the Jewish mitzvahs without associating it to a commandment, and a Jew follows a mitzvah without realizing the truth behind it. Okay. Let's see. I'm not sure, Rosora, if that's a question. It looks like you stopped mid-sentence. I'm not sure if you're asking something or saying something. Again, she's writing that perhaps a Noahide behaves in accordance to a truth that is beyond a Jewish mitzvah. Without associating it to a commandment. Meaning to say that a Noahide would just intuitively follow something which makes sense, right? And a Jew follows the mitzvah without realizing the truth behind it. So it seems to be in that case, I'm assuming you're asking who's better. So it would seem to be that for sure the Noahide is better in this case, because he's following what makes sense to his mind, whereas Rashi says if a person follows a mitzvah and does not know why he's doing it, so it's worthless. Which makes sense, because the whole purpose of doing a mitzvah means to say that I am now doing an act which my mind tells me is right, it's correct, it's morally virtuous. But just to do an act without even understanding why I'm doing it, so where's the perfection? There is no perfection. So I assume that's what you're asking, Razor. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
It seems, though, that by doing the mitzvah, sometimes even though you don't understand it, by doing it, you glean better understanding of it.
How is that?
Well, I think I can just give a personal example. For me, when I decided to create a Shabbat kind of learning and idea of bringing people into my home and discussing ideas around a meal, you know, I don't do it exactly the way the Jews do, but the ideas around it helped me understand better the whole purpose behind Shabbat, even though initially when I went into it, I just did it to do it, if you can see the difference. I gleaned a better understanding.
You mean actually physically going through the action gave you some realization about the benefit?
Right.
Right, that I agree. That's true. I was thinking actually while I was talking that perhaps I don't know why I'm supposed to give charity, but then I give it to somebody who's poor and then their face lights up with a smile. So now you start seeing the benefit. You're right. Right, so then there would be something that you learn at that point. So then you are benefiting from the mitzvah. So then you do get it. But if you don't get any concept, if there's no perception at all, even while you're doing it, so then it's useless.
Right.
So you're saying that you're saying that you can get the
perception.
What's that?
Go ahead. Aren't we instructed to go ahead and do the commandments, do first, and then understand?
Oh, yes. I'm not saying that a person should not do it. I'm just saying that the gain is lost if there's no understanding.
I see. Okay.
Yes, we have to. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Rabbi, did I understand in something you were saying that there was an implication that teachers of Torah should be Jews, or that there's any restriction against a Noahide being a teacher?
No, there's no restriction on Noahide being a teacher. I'm saying that the prohibition possibly for a Noahide to study Torah outside of what is commanded could be because it gives the impression of him, it could give the impression that now he is a valid source for, you know, Torah authority. And then that would, since he's not as learned as the Jew who has to keep everything else, so the Noahide doesn't have to observe all those other laws, so then his learning may fall short. It may not. But it could be one possible reason why there's that restriction. Because God wants there to remain a single focus of who the real Torah educator is, so this way Torah survives every generation. But there's no restriction for the, Noahide. How else are the next generation of Noahides going to learn if it's not the Jews and Noahides that teach them those laws?
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, so I guess what we'll do is, I'll start looking more. Actually, I'm still going through the areas in the Talmud about Noahide law. So as I see more, and again, I do want to confer with the guidance of Rabbi Trait and Rabbi Mann in terms of the outlook, the philosophy, in terms of, you know, Psak, the actual ruling, because that's really, Doug, what you were asking, to really have a... concrete understanding of how to practice the Noahide laws, correct?
That's correct. Thank you.
Okay, so I'll speak with them about that for sure. And let me just see here, two more questions, and we'll wrap it up after this. Rosora and Alberto. So Rosora is writing as follows. Are Jews supposed to follow the mitzvos even if they don't understand them? Yes, Rosora. We just took that up. Is this in order to be a model for non-Jews? Yes, that is true as well. And also, but primarily it's for our own perfection. Next part of your question is, if the mitzvos are supposed to be a model for non-Jews, are they supposed to end following Jewish mitzvos by appreciating them by observation? Yes. I mean, the Torah actually says that when the non-Jews see the Jews following the Torah, they will look at them, and they will say, what a wise and understanding people this is. So it will, that is God's objective, clearly from the verses in Deuteronomy, that by our observance, we will make a great impression for the rest of the world. Alberto is asking as follows, would a Noahide who follows some behavior that is inspired by an ideal, and that ideal coincides with Torah ideas, be rewarded for that? Yes. That was basically Abraham. Abraham followed ideas that were primarily fundamentals of the Torah that was going to give him later on, and he received reward for following what his mind told him was true. And he follows and he says, and it's better than a Jew who follows Torah without proper meditation on it? Yes, of course. If a Jew just follows something and doesn't even think about what he's doing, of course the Noahide is far better, because he now is following a lifestyle based on thought and conviction of what is true. So he's following God's will. If a Jew is just doing something, he doesn't even see the concept behind it, doesn't know it's God's will. Or he may know it's God's will, but he doesn't see the perfection in it, so he's not as perfected as the Noahide. All right, so the Noahide doesn't necessarily have to know to have his actions rewarded. But if a person does not, well, let me just say this though. If a Noahide or a Jew follow the Torah exactly, but neither one agrees that God exists, neither one of them has got any perfection, because they are not following God's will anymore. Even if a Jew would follow the Torah inside out perfectly, and a Noahide would do it as well, but both of them had no knowledge of God, it's useless, it's worthless, because they're not following the system as being a reflection of the Creator's will. That primary component is missing. The Talmud says, according to one opinion, that there was only one command that God gave Adam, and that was not to be involved in idolatry, meaning recognize me and everything else will flow from that. So if that one concept wasn't there, forget it. Adam's existence would have been worthless. So we really have to understand the gravity of that. We must be following a system. And the Shema prayer that we say every day says that you're supposed to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. The operative word there is all your heart, all your soul, all your might. That means in every action during the day, a person can reach the level. It sounds like it might be a little exhausting. It sounds like you might not be able to do it, but God's saying in the Torah that you can do this. You can live your life where all your activities, I think it's Rambam, Maimonides who even says it, that when you're eating to be strong enough so you can learn and live a proper life. When you even have intercourse, it's to make the body strong, to give it its energy, to have release in order that you can have your energies properly attuned. When you talk, when you work, every action is to be targeting the one goal of understanding more about God. And a lot of times to do that, you have to have a house. You have to have a place to live so you have the books, so you can have a shelter to learn. But to do all that, you have to work. So that means even your labor is considered a service of God because you're now doing what's necessary to procure the backdrop, the situation for your learning. And Razor is asking, can we say that God's system is the ideal system so that any human being has the possibility to reach God by free will? Yes, of course. Like Rabbi Chaim once mentioned, that very few individuals can get to God without... he says, like, I think what he said is like this, that a person can reach God without the Torah, but how many did you have? You had one. You had an Abraham. So the Torah is really vital for 99% of the population. And Alberto is asking as follows, but you don't agree that if a Noahide does not have proper Torah education, it is because Israel is not doing his job to teach the nations? So how can such a Gentile be blamed for some wrong concepts about God if he got no learning chance? I once asked this question to Rabbi Chait. How is it you have these pygmies and you have these backward people, you have these... Even today, you have cultures that seem to be so isolated, they could say, I never had the opportunity. Rabbi Chait answered, he says, no, that God gives a person, every individual has an opportunity sometime in their life to choose living the proper life. So you cannot shift the blame from the self. I mean, think about it too. God has the ability, he knows the thoughts of every person. And he could set up the situation for any person to come in contact with a possible way of, you know, thinking like Abraham. He was in a culture just like these backward civilizations today. You have in Africa where they have like the witch doctors and you have the people that are so tribal and so archaic in their ways and voodoo. And this still goes on. That was no different than Abraham's time. Yet, look what Abraham did. He had the inborn intelligence to understand it was false. So God's not going to create a soul that's going to have a futile existence. He's going to give it that opportunity. And, of course, the question comes up, well, what about a child that dies, didn't get a chance? And this, there is one rabbi who I saw recently who said that there are people who die without justice, which is itself is a question, does that really happen? But he wants to say, yes, a person can be swept away, and there is something in the Torah which talks about with the death of the firstborns, I believe it's said over there, that once the destroyer is let loose, it does not distinguish between good and bad. That means there are certain situations where even somebody who may not be deserving is going to be wiped away. So where is the justice? So this rabbi, Mitzudas David, says, the justice will be when God resurrects people in the future. Then they will get their final reward. So you cannot look at a person in this life and look how they lived and died and assess God's justice with them because this is not the end of their existence. There is yet another existence when God resurrects the dead. And that is when they will get their reward. Okay. It's a very interesting point. Rabbi Mann heard that he liked that because that can actually answer the people's questions on the Holocaust, too. How do the innocent people get wiped away? Well, here's a rabbi that's saying openly, don't assess a person's life just based on their initial existence here on Earth because there is yet another existence that they have here. Right? That's a fundamental in Judaism, and that's brought down in the Torah itself. Okay. Sarah is writing as follows. Getting back to the soul, I agree a Jewish soul is not any better than Gentiles, but could the souls be different? Well, Sarah, you would have to give proof for a difference, but as we were discussing, God only created man once. And after he made Adam and Eve, he made a change once in their psyche, not in their soul, and he gave them the conscience, which allowed them to have a moral system that would help them in terms of not sinning anymore. It would be a secondary break system, we called it. So even if intellectually a person made a mistake, was about to sin, but now the morality would jump in. It would step in and make the person feel bad or guilty, and hopefully that would be a second, like a reserve parachute, so to speak, that would help them to slow down the process of sinning because they feel bad now. So even if they made an intellectual error and they decided to sin, and about the time they were going to sin, the emotions would now kick in and make them feel bad. That's why God gave it. But after that point, there was no change to the human design. So there was no basis whatsoever to say that Jew and Gentile are any different whatsoever. Okay, Sarah? We don't just say things without proof. There has to be proof. Okay? And you see that God selected Ruth. How many times have we said this? That God selected Ruth, who was a convert, to be the forerunner of King David, King Solomon, and our Messiah is a descendant of a convert. You see that God does not care one way or the other about who your parents were. It depends how you use your life. Unculus is praised by the rabbis as being one of the greatest teachers with the way he wrote his commentary. He was a convert. So many of the rabbis in the Talmud were converts themselves, not even descendants of converts. They themselves were converts, and they became Jewish leaders because we recognize it doesn't matter how you were born, it's irrelevant. What are you doing now with your life? Do you have the right ideas? Do you have the right values? Do you have great knowledge? Then teach me. I want to hear it. Maimonides said, learn the truth from whoever speaks it. Right, Maimonides praised Aristotle as being like a level below the prophets. So I'm probably doing an injustice. But he talked about Aristotle as being like the perfection of man. Aristotle wasn't Jewish. And Maimonides didn't give that praise to another Jew. He gave it to Aristotle. So you see, the greatest codifier of Jewish law said openly that we don't have any distinctions between Jew and non-Jew. What did the person do with his mind, with his life? That's it. Okay. And Jay Khanna is asking, were Rabbi Akiva's parents converts? I don't know. I do not know. Rosora has another question, asked as follows. I heard about mamzer, and just for those of you who don't know, a mamzer means that a child of an illicit sexual relationship. So if a man slept with a married woman, the son would be called a mamzer. Okay, perhaps this is out of the topic, but I'd like to know how a mamzers are considered. Have they the same possibility to reach God? Okay, why are they punished by others' errors? Now, the punishment by a mamzer just means that a mamzer can't marry anybody else but another mamzer. I think, if I'm not mistaken. I haven't really studied that area thoroughly. But that's a penalty for the parents. That is hopefully going to deter a couple that are not supposed to have intercourse from doing it. Because if they would stop and think that if we have intercourse and we have a child from this union, this child will not be able to have a marriage probably to anybody because he's not going to find somebody. And he's prohibited from any Jew. So then hopefully that'll stop those two people from having that momentary satisfaction, which is going to result in the destruction of the child's life. It's really for the parents. It's not a punishment to the child. Okay, Sarah in Israel is writing, I heard from other rabbis that a Gentile can have a Jewish soul, and that is why they have a strong desire to return to their roots. Okay, Sarah, I've heard that too. I've heard it stated, and I saw there was a, actually, a
that your conference will expire in 10 minutes.
Okay, so I said we have to wrap this up. So I'll just make this the last point, that I believe Rosora was the one who had sent me to two different websites where two rabbis were saying that the Jew has a better soul than the non-Jew. So I wrote to one, to both of them. One of them conceded and agreed that he was wrong, and he changed his website, or at least he said he would, so give him the benefit of the doubt. The other rabbi, even after three emails, did not respond. And he wants to quote a Talmud portion And he wants to say that the souls, not the souls, I'm just trying to think how the Talmudic portion goes. I think that the idea was that when God made the covenant with the Jews at Sinai, it says that the covenant is between the people that were there and also those who are not there. Meaning to say, simply, that the future generations of the Jews are also obliged by the covenant, even though they weren't present at Sinai. But also, it's going to be something which will be binding on the convert as well. So nowhere does it say that the convert or the future Jews' souls were at Sinai. As a matter of fact, the verse says that this covenant is binding upon you who are here and those of you who are not here. So clearly, right, my friend Benji Kaplan pointed this out to me so concisely and so poignantly that the verse itself says that there are generations that are not here at Sinai. That means this concept that all souls were at Sinai is a contradiction to the very verse. But what does it mean that the obligation is upon the future generations? It means to say that Sinai itself was the proof that God exists because intelligent voice emanating from fire was the precise miracle that God orchestrated. Why? Why intelligent voice emanating from fire? Because intelligence or life can exist in any other element. You basically have four elements. You have earth, you have air, you have water, and you have fire. In the first three, you can have life, and you do have life. You have life in the coldest places on earth. In ice, there are little insects. In the air, thousands of miles up, there are birds, there are spiders that are swept up because of the webs, catch the wind. In water, you have fish, of course. In the deepest soil, you have, and in the sands of the deserts, you have animals that live under the sand. And the nostrils, you see, are so narrow that it filters out the sand, but just takes in the air. So all God's designs are perfect. But there's one element in which life cannot coexist, and that is fire. So God created Sinai, where it was a proof that whatever was causing this intelligent voice that was emanating from the fire, it could not be of this world. That is why he orchestrated that event in that manner, my understanding. So we see that Sinai was the proof of God's existence. And any Gentile, any Jew in the future that decides to take on the Torah system and sees this proof, it's as if that they were there. As if, meaning the proof is clear enough today as it was, it's just as clear today as it is if I was standing there myself. So this idea about a soul of a Jew being better or different, completely baseless, there's no source for it. There is no source for it. All right? If people say this to you, ask them, where's your source? You will find that they I don't know. The answer is yes, they don't know because there is no source. Okay. Next time you hear something, if it's a rabbi, I don't care who it is, Sarah, you want to make a claim to me? Show me the source. You show me that this is part of Judaism only by showing me a source. Don't give me some esoteric book. Don't give me something which somebody heard, somebody say, repeated story. Show me in the Torah, in the prophets, in the writings. Where is it? Show me in the Talmud. Go only to those authoritative sources if you want to know it's Judaism or not. Okay, we're running out of time because of the conference call, so let's just wrap it up here. We will continue next week, same time, 11:15. And again, we'll continue on the topic. We're going to, more in terms of, laws between Noahide, laws of the Jew, and any questions, feel free to email them during the week or communicate that way, and we'll pick it up then. Any last questions or comments?
Very good.
Yes, thanks very much, Rabbi.
Okay,
thank
good.
You, Rabbi.
My pleasure. Okay, so we'll post this online. So in about 20 minutes or so, if anybody missed any of the class, you'll be able to go to the audio page or even the new postings. We'll put it up there.
Please note that your conference will expire in 5 minutes.
Okay, so we'll put it up there. So in case anybody missed any part of the session, you will be able to hear it in its entirety. And again, if you want, get a hold of last week's Jewish Press, not this past 2 days ago, but I guess the 25th, maybe? Is that the right date, May 25th? You'll see. It's page 7. You'll take a look, go through the sources that were brought down. just, you know, I'm directing this specifically to Brad, because you brought up earlier that, you know, are Jews doing, you know, getting the word out that there is no difference? Well, hopefully this is reaching a lot of people. There's a big paper, and I'm going to write again in this week, hopefully to get a little bit more you know, publicity on it, and just clarify the points that we discussed today so people can really let this sink in. Let them see what is the means for accepting what is Torah and what is not Torah. What is true and not has to be based on what makes sense, what's reasonable. Okay, so good week to everybody. And we'll speak to you then.
Thank you.
You have a great week too, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Well,
is Jewish Press an online or a...
Oh, yes. Yeah, you can go to jewishpress.com and look. You could type in, I guess, the title that they named it. I had a different title, but it's called The Heretical Notion of Jewish Superiority. That's the name of the article. The Heretical Notion of Jewish Superiority. So I guess if you type in the word heretical, that'll probably bring up very few results, and you'll be able to find it quickly. All right, or look under Ben-Chaim, B-E-N-C-H-A-I-M. Then you'll probably find it right away. All right, let me know what you think.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Okay, so that concludes today's class. We will place the class online shortly, so if you missed any part, you will be able to listen to it. And we'll look forward to seeing everybody next week. Have a good week to everybody.